This is a show about technology.
I've got a steel plate in my head. I've got a steel plate in my head.
There's a first aid kit in the next room.
Steel plate in my head. From Vietnam.
Sorry.
Okay. We have a caller on the line.
Look out.
This recording. Oh, it's that bonehead said he was in Vietnam. He must be on drugs.
Colm, are you on drugs?
Yes.
Yes. He don't know first thing about Vietnam. He must be on drugs.
Yes.
Okay.
Got me on the radio, do you? You're not got me on the radio, do you?
Yes.
No. Oh, no. Turn me off.
Don't bank where ass monkeys bank.
Sound advice. From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and this is episode number 26 of Little Brother, dated the 1st of December 2001. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, and the show is Little Brother, the topic is technology, and your phone calls are welcome at area code 518-276-6248. Also, before we get started, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union. With that in mind, the phone number again is area code 518-276-6248. Tonight we have, or this afternoon, I keep saying tonight because I'm used to being on in the evenings, but this afternoon, Phil and Lil are not here for some reason, and that's all right. I mean, they have lives too. And we'll pass this on because we have Pete Fizette is in the studio. Say hi, Pete.
Hi, Pete.
Yeah, and somehow I knew you were going to do that. And we also have an intern in the studio tonight. Say hello, Fong.
How we doing?
Doing all right. And with that out of the way, we're going to get started here with some items out of the Risks Digest. California law enforcement officials made the largest seizure of counterfeit software in U.S. history, estimated to be worth about $100 million. The products, which originated in Taiwan, included about 31,000 high-quality copies of Microsoft's Windows Millennium Edition and 2,000 professional operating systems, and tens of thousands of copies of Symantec's security software. They look so good that the purchaser could not know that it was a counterfeit, said Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca. Some of the bogus discs even carried the "Do not make illegal copies of this disc" warning. Authorities have arrested three people on bribery, conspiracy, and smuggling charges, and another has been charged with state violations of counterfeiting a registered trademark. Hey, Phil and Lil have just walked into the studio.
Yeah.
And what we'll do is we'll take a moment and get them sorted out, and we'll be right back. Okay, and we're back. Let's see if we can hear you guys in there. Say hello, Lil. No, we can't hear you.
Hello, hello.
Hey, there you are.
Hey, we actually got them to work this time. It's great.
Yeah, it's a miracle, isn't it? All right.
A Christmas miracle.
We need a few of those.
Or maybe a Hanukkah miracle, I don't know. The holiday of your choice miracle.
Could be a Kwanzaa miracle.
It could be. It could be a Ramadan. Isn't Ramadan about?
I think so.
Or did it pass?
I'm sure that somebody will be happy to call us and set us straight on when Ramadan is.
Mm.
Or actually, I'll tell you what. We'll ask Faisal when he comes in to do the next show.
Alrighty.
All right. That out of the way. Do you want to do that one now, or do you want me to move ahead a little bit here?
Sure, I can do it. I actually ended up linked to this person's website. Let's see here. The following is David McGowan's story in his own words. Oh, no, I don't want to read that. His words aren't
Yeah, why don't you skip down a little
eloquent.
Bit.
I'll read what's this all about here. It says, the story began in 1999 when David McGowan worked on the computer systems at DeKalb Technical College in Georgia. Like many other geeks, David realized that most of the machines on campus sat idle most of the time, good computing power going to waste. That very thought has led to the creation of several companies looking to tap into that power. The idea is to chop up large computer jobs into small portions and shoot these bits of work to individual computers over the internet. You could eventually pay computer owners for the spare time of their machines. One such outfit, Distributed.net, has been testing the idea since 1997 by cracking encryption systems, products that scramble data so that unauthorized people can't read it. Interested techies can go to the Distributed.net website and download software that runs when the machines aren't doing something else. The software toils away at cracking a code, a task that would take millions of years for a single computer. But when chopped up and spread across tens of thousands of machines, the work should be finished in just a few years. By that time, they'll have new encryption things that you'll have to decode. But To draw in lots of participants, the distributed.net is offering $1,000 to the person whose computer actually cracks the code. To improve their odds of winning, people with access to lots of computers have installed the software on many systems. That's what David did at his college. The state of Georgia doesn't agree with this use of computers. Under state law, David's effort might be considered misuse of the state's computers. And in Georgia, that's a felony. In a cry for help published on the website annantech.com, David said that the state wants $415,000 in compensation for lost computing and network capacity. Might I point out, capacity they weren't using, so how could it be lost? And of course, there's always that possible prison sentence.
One would think, of course, that the practical upshot of this is when DeKalb is not using the computing power, they ought to be paying the 59 cents a second back to the taxpayers of the state of Georgia.
Hell yeah. And of course, there's always that possible prison sentence of 15 years to consider. Okay, and then there's updates on it. The first one says, based on the fact that the CNET News article specifically mentions David's place of employment, Singular has summarily terminated him from his job in fear of bad publicity. Remember that? Singular. Like Singular Wireless? Yeah. They fire people for being talked about. He is now not only staring at mounting legal bills and the possibility of prison, he has no income. This has gotten completely out of hand. The state of Georgia has no concern for the ridiculous actions and the unnecessary grief they are causing this family. And an update as of October 15th, arrested, booked, and now awaiting trial, the state of Georgia has proceeded with the indictment and have handed down 8 felony counts, 1 count of computer theft, 7 counts of computer trespass. Each count carries a 15-year possible prison term for 120 years maximum possible term. Each count also carries $50,000 in fines, plus the original $415,000 restitution and damages. So the state is seeking $815,000 from a man that now has no job.
That's right.
That's right. That's a lot of garnishing of wages right there.
Well, it's theoretically garnishing an infinite number of wages, since any number divided by zero ultimately approaches infinity.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, did you see what just happened to my headphones?
I did see what just happened to your headphones. That happens around here from time to time.
I have a headphone dangling next to my right ear, but fortunately the left one still works. Now, the update as of November 8th is, standing between Ms. Shansman and Mr. Joyner today in front of the judge, David McGowan's trial date was set for December 10th, 2001. All this information can be found on freemcgowan.com, and there's lots of things you can do. You can quote-unquote sign a petition online, and you can send supportive messages to David, to help him through his, emotionally at least, through his plight. There's lots of other things you could do. So if you're interested, just go to freemcgowan.com.
Hey, while we're on the topic of, while we're on the topic of outstanding lawsuits, we do have some new information on the Sklyarov case, and I hope you're happy with my pronunciation of it this time.
Sklyarov.
Okay,
Sklyarov.
Fine. This is an update from the status conference held in the case against Dmitry Sklyarov, who, just to jog your memory, was a visiting Russian programmer arrested in the U.S. for allegedly violating the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act by writing in Russia software that is legal in Russia, and Elcomsoft, his Russia-based employer. As expected, the only issue discussed at the hearing was the setting of dates for pretrial motions. The issues were divided into two categories. DMCA, possible claims are unconstitutionality, including vagueness under the First Amendment and lack of constitutional authority, and non-DMCA issues, specifically issues of jurisdiction, a bill of particulars, and the conspiracy charge. Assuming that the case is not dismissed because of the motions, there will be a hearing to set a trial date on April 15th, 2002. How many years of this guy's life are we going to steal? That's what I want to know. I mean, to give you some background, for those of you who may have been hiding out under a rock, Dmitry Sklyarov, you happy?
Yes, there is no I between the K and the L.
Okay.
I just want to point out.
Dmitry Sklyarov is, as I said, a Russian programmer, and he wrote a computer program while in Russia working for his Russian employer that would break the encryption used on Adobe eBooks. Now, while at first it may sound like that's not such a great thing to be doing, the fact of the matter is this took place overseas where a U.S. court should have absolutely no jurisdiction. When he came to the U.S. in order to give a speech at a hacker convention, as he was checking out of his hotel room, he was arrested for his alleged violations of the DMCA. And it's wrong. They have absolutely no jurisdiction over something that didn't even take place in the U.S. And actually, I believe I have some evidence of that fact here, too.
What? You mean we don't have jurisdiction overseas?
No.
Why the hell
we
not?
Don't.
We can't tell the Russians what to do?
Nope.
The English?
Nope. Mm. Sorry. Nope. Apparently, the only ones we can get away with doing that to right now are Afghans. let me see here. Somewhere around here, I had an item about the case, the French case against Yahoo. Let me see if I can find it real quick here. Do-do-do-do.
So how exactly would one say Yahoo in French?
I am assuming that
Yahoo.
One would say Yahoo.
Yahoo.
Or something to that effect.
You drop the last O.
Do you, Yahoo?
Est-ce que vous Yahoo-ay? Okay. let's see. U.S. District Court Judge Jeremy Fogel ruled that a French court decision holding Yahoo liable for First Amendment-protected expression on its U.S. website could not be enforced in U.S. courts. It's an important decision for international free speech rights on the Internet, as it could help prevent a race to the bottom that would allow the most restrictive countries of the world to chill the First Amendment rights of Americans on American websites. EFF joined the ACLU and several other groups in an amicus brief arguing that Yahoo's U.S.-based website was protected by First Amendment and warning that that enforcement of the French decision here risked subjecting all U.S. speakers to the U.S. well, it should say English-speaking, well, anyway, to the more speech-restrictive laws of other countries. Basically, that strikes me as evidence that we are saying that nobody has jurisdiction over us. Therefore, it only follows, unless we intend to be the bully of the world, which apparently we do, that we don't have
always
any jurisdiction elsewhere.
Mm.
Anyway, while we're on the topic of computer abuse, I'm going to take a quick humorous sideline here with something that one of the particular computer abuses that annoys a great many people. This credit where credit is appropriate. This goes to... this is taken from the comic strip User Friendly, published in Canada by Iliad. And it goes as follows. Spam, O glorious luncheon meat, thou glisten pink and wet. Thy name besmirched by sewer scum who have clogged the internet. Young live teens, easy cash, they cry with raucous vigor. Well aware where they lined up, we'd love to pull the trigger. But rather we should pass a law for each spam mail one sends. The guilty party shall consume a brick of meat and ends.
Yummy.
Is it fair to call spam meat? Isn't it more of a meat byproduct?
I think it's something like that.
It's meat-esque.
It's meatoid.
Carnivore-esque.
Brick-o-meat.
Didn't Hormel, didn't they come out... make a statement about people's use of the term spam, and because people were wondering, you know, whether they were going to consider that copyright violation. And then weren't they really picky about it? They're like, as long as it's not with a capital S.
It wasn't just a capital S; it had to be all four capital letters, because when you look at it on a can of spam, that's the way it's that is the way it's printed, is all four capital letters.
How did it come to be that junk mail? Came to be referred to as spam.
Actually, there's a very good story behind it. Yeah, yeah.
You know what? From now on, I'm going to always refer to spam mail and specify all four capitals. Spam with all four capitals. That's right. I want to see if Hormel will come after me.
Well,
I want to cause them trouble, because have you ever had their corned beef hash? You
know,
they deserve.
Come
they deserve
on.
To be trouble.
You know I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah, not your whole life. So I've seen you eat meat.
Anyhow.
And besides, you might technically be able to eat that and still remain vegetarian.
We're not going to go there. I think that, you know, I will admit, when I was younger and more foolish, I ate the stuff quite readily. But then I developed taste buds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember you with the bologna and the toaster oven.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What are you doing?
Oh, I have one of these lovely... Listerine has a pocket pack thing now, not to be a commercial or anything, but it's actually this weird little piece of film, and you put it on your tongue, and it melts, and you have instant Listerine. And this is the pack from it that I'm playing with. I find them endlessly entertaining. I want to make a race car out of it, actually.
Okay.
So look, it's got the right shape and everything.
Okay. I think, actually, I'm going to hand this story to Pete, because this one seems like it's right up his alley. Take a minute and go over that one. I'll move on to another story while you're doing that.
It could, because we've got off on quite the tangent.
Boy, have we. let's see here. From the Risks Digest, there's an item here that talks about the risks of national ID cards. This is from Adam Shostak. He says, I believe that there is an important risk that of reliance will accompany a high-tech national ID card. Every terrorist commits their first act of terrorism at some time in their life, and before that time, they can't be in any database of known terrorists. Once you start issuing cards, people will start relying on identity verification rather than threat management. We'll see people relying on background checks rather than x-rays. We'll see special lines for frequent flyers who are known trustworthy. They differ from pilots and flight crew in that they don't run into coworkers who can notice and react to strange behavior before the flight. If you want to keep knives and guns off the planes, the answer lies in x-rays, magnetometers, and other searching technology, not in believing that you know who's who. Many of the national ID card risks come from a layer of indirection from the real problem, which is not, is Alice trusted, but is the person in front of me trusted? Never mind whether or not the person in front of me is actually Alice. National ID cards not only do nothing to solve the problem, they distract us from attempting to solve it. Peter Newman writes in the Risks Digest that the latest quarterly computer security report card put together by Congressman Steve Horn's House Reform Committee, Government Efficiency Subcommittee, and the GAO and OMB, damn, that's a mouthful, gives the government an F grade, down from D minus a year ago, based on lax protection of federal computer networks against hackers, terrorists, and others. Two-thirds of the federal agencies flunked this time, including the Departments of Defense, Commerce, Energy, Justice, Treasury, Agriculture, Aid, Education, Health and Human Services, Interior, Labor, Transportation, Small Business, and Veterans Affairs. The B-plus given to the National Science Foundation was tops, with Social Security getting a C-plus and NASA a C-minus. As expected, the GAO found systems with no passwords, with password as the password, and with unencrypted accessible password files. Let's see. Brett Glass submits that he was planning a trip to Denver and he wanted to stay at the Adams Mark Motel, or hotel rather. I guess he has a lot of money. Not knowing the toll-free number for the chain, he called 800-555-1212, which is toll-free information, to ask for the number. Toll-free directory assistance was powered by Tell Me, said a recorded message. He told the recording he wanted the number of the Adams Mark. However, instead of receiving the correct number for the chain listed on their website, he received a different number. This number was not actually the number of the hotel chains, but rather of a third-party room wholesaler in Orlando, Florida. Calling the correct number, he confirmed that the hotel chain had no idea that calls were being diverted to a third party. As the economy continues into recession, we're likely to see more and more instances of customer hijacking, in which companies, perceiving their markets as a zero-sum game, work to grab customers from one another in any way possible, regardless of ethics. Slamming and hijacking of ISP's DSL customers by ILEX are only two of the many other hijacking techniques which are now becoming prevalent in slowly growing or shrinking markets. If you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth about all of this, please do. The number here is area code 518-276-6248. What do you think, Pete? Is that interesting to you?
I think it's interesting. It's an example of what's going on that we can read about.
Why don't you move up a little bit?
Sure. This is a story from CNN.com. It's titled Mickey Mouse Goes Wireless by Ken Mingus. On any given day, between 100,000 and 150,000 visitors crowd into Walt Disney World in Florida, largely unaware that the 47-square-mile theme park is almost completely enveloped by an invisible wireless web. while families and other patrons watch Goofy and Mickey Mouse on parade, seek thrills on rides, and or head for the nearest hot dog stand, the attraction's 55,000 cast members, as Disney employees are called, quietly rely on an 802.11b LAN to do everything from authorized credit cards, purchases, up to order up shuttle buses, and even track visitors as they wander through the park. Murshid S. Khan, Director of Telecommunications and Technology Support at Walt Disney World, talked about the theme park's use of wireless technology during Stanford, Connecticut-based Gartner Inc.'s Wireless LAN Summit. According to Khan, Disney World, which includes the famed Magic Kingdom and Epcot Center, is part of an interconnected world that includes as many as 200 wireless access points hidden throughout the park. The access points are used to facilitate the flow of information and data behind the scenes. Khan described how the technology use has evolved, as well as where he believes Burbank, California-based The Walt Disney Company plans to go with the wireless LANs in the future. His comments came on the last day of the three-day Gartner event, which ended November 19th. The decision to provide 802.11b coverage for most of the amusement park grew in response to visitors' complaints about being unable to use credit cards to buy food, beverages, at Disney World merchandise, Khan said. We were running a food and wine festival, and a lot of people had complained in the past that they couldn't use credit cards to pay for items, Khan said. When people go to the park, they want to use credit cards, so we changed that. With a wireless LAN in place, employees can now accept credit card purchases and complete authorizations quickly, he said, speeding up transactions and making it easier for visitors to buy food and merchandise. The technology also allows employees to be mobile, meaning they can boost revenue by bringing merchandise and food to people who may be stuck in line waiting for rides. They're not static, they're mobile, Khan said, and the mobility has enhanced revenue generation. Technology is also used for guest tracking on Disney cruises, especially during stops when travelers disembark for island excursions. As each person arrives on board one of the company's cruise ships, Khan said, he is given a card. As passengers leave and return to the ship, they are required to swipe the cards in a device that tracks who has come and gone. That tells us who's on board, Khan said. Let's say 200 people have gone onto an island. If we see that 200 people have not come back, we know how many people are missing. I can see faults in that, but although the company's goal is to provide a wireless workplace for its employees throughout the park, there have been challenges in implementing the technology, Khan said. Bandwidth is an issue in some areas. Integration with wired networks and applications is an issue. Seamless roaming is an issue, he said. The biggest hurdle is security. Ensuring that tens of thousands of credit card numbers are sufficiently protected during multiple transactions to prevent theft and working constantly to keep sniffers from illegal connecting. Khan said Disney uses 128-bit encryption and other means of detecting possible intrusions with software. Though he declined to be more specific about how the company protects its network, Khan stressed that Disney is constantly looking to beef up security, especially as the network grows and is used for more services. During a question and answer session after he spoke, however, Khan acknowledged that the wireless LANs are still a new technology that may not be right for all businesses. This is an emerging technology, he said. It's going to take a while before everyone feels comfortable with it. For small business groups, you can implement it, but for larger Fortune 500 companies, I'm not sure that the rate of return is there. You have to be comfortable before you jump in. If someone is asking me about applying this for office automation, I'm not sure I would do that at this point, Khan said. And while he said Disney plans a gradual move to a faster 802.11a network in the years ahead, he said the company has no plans to deploy Bluetooth technology. Bluetooth is a wireless technology with a shorter range that is designed primarily for personal area network among devices such as telephones, handhelds, laptop printers, or fax machines. By contrast, 802.11b networks are seen as better suited for work groups and other places where wireless connections can be spread apart. Asked whether Disney might ever offer some of its bandwidth to park visitors, Khan said no. In addition to bandwidth concerns, he said there are also more practical worries. We need you to come to the park and enjoy the park, he said. If we start opening up internet cafes, you won't do that. And that's the end of the story. And there are many, many comments that we could have regarding this.
Why don't we take them on in a few minutes? We need to take a quick break for a station ID. Little Brother will return in just a minute.
Once again, the staff and management of WRPI proudly present How to Tell WRPI from All the Other Radio Stations Ever.
Number 32, Artistic Interpretation of Musical Masterpieces.
Join us next time as we bring you more of How to Tell WRPI from All the Other Radio Stations Ever, a seemingly endless saga brought to you as a public service by WRPI in Troy.
The show is Little Brother. Topic is technology. Phone number is 518-276-6248 if you have a comment. And the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. Okay, Pete, you want to start this one?
Yeah, sure.
Because I know 802.11 is your field.
It is. And I would start off by saying what I'm noticing out there that's going on out there is there's a privatization going on with what's actually public, that everybody has a right to commodity, which is our 802.11 airspace. It was a little piece of bandwidth that we have to use for different purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody that has their own agendas out there grabbing a piece of it and laying claim to, like, you know, we have a wireless network in your area. Well, actually, that's actually your wireless network that they're laying claim to in your area.
Is in our area.
So, you know, that, you know, it's something that everybody has a right to.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we have to avoid is the privatization of something that has been given to everybody. And it's really just a matter of how you view it. Certainly, it's very nice to have an entity come along and manage something that we all have to agree to use in a certain way. And so there's a little bit of a trade-off between true privatization and just an overall management, which is representative of the people that it's meant to be used by. I've also noticed that some of the high-powered telecommunications companies, I won't mention their names, but we all know who they are actually grappling onto this 802.11b and laying claim to it as a new way for them to roll out services to you. And what they don't want you to know is that this is something that you already own. So they're basically selling you something that you already own. That'll be the new privatization feature that's going on.
That's an interesting angle on it, actually, because when I look at it, I see 802.11, yes, it's public space, but a corporation has the same privilege of using this space as anybody else does, and I see it. What they're offering is not the space itself, but rather the service that they're providing through the space. Of course, you could also look like that as you could also look at that as being a railroad came along and decided to put a track down in the middle of a public park. You've got the right to use the park still, but there's this train sitting in the middle of it.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying that, you know.
So I mean, there's
I'm not saying that every use of this is wrong, or it shouldn't be managed by some consolidated entity that has an interest in making money on it. I'm not saying that it shouldn't participate, but at least it shouldn't be presented as like this is something that they are selling to you. It's theirs. They're selling it to you. It's really yours, and it's going to be managed by them. That's really the perspective that should be presented. And what's interesting is that Disney here is using this technology, and they're going to run into trouble because if someone walks in with their own, I mean, you can walk around with your own 802.11 system. Like, you know, it's not illegal to bring a sniffer into Disney because you can bring an 802.11 device wherever you want. You can bring a Bluetooth device wherever you want. You can cause conflicts, not on purpose, but, you know, when you walk into a Disney park, are they going to say, you know, turn off all your Bluetooth devices, turn off all your 802.11 devices?
Does a private property issue come into play here? Disney's theme parks are private property, and pretty much they can, from that, set the rules.
You know, that's an interesting point. That's I don't have the exact answer to that, but I think it's you can literally go wherever you want with this, and that's why these other entities can come along and say, plant an 802.11 device on your property and sell you what is already yours. But that's a really good issue about who really has control over the airspace in a particular domain, and I don't think there is any. It's just literally like freedom of speech. You can go wherever you want with these things.
Sure. And the other thing I worry about on this particular one is they're talking about using 128-bit encryption. And, of course, the first thing that comes to mind when you put 802.11 together with 128-bit encryption is wireless equivalency protocol. Well, that's been cracked. That's been cracked many, many months ago. In fact, I think that's been already cracked the last time you were on the show.
Oh yeah, it's been cracked for a while. There's two different ways to crack it, I suppose. And the reason it has been cracked is because it has a fixed key, and that's the real key. Once you figure out what that key is, it doesn't change over the sessions. So that once you crack it, you can use it until a administrator comes along and changes it manually. So that's the thing that they're changing in the new 802.11 specifications, is that they're going to change from a fixed key to a dynamically allocated key, which is really what they should have had all along.
Agreed.
Why they didn't, it's, you know, it was never really meant to, it was just a... They always intended for the users of the 802.11 spec to use a security layers in and above the physical layer. So you know, if you did run an 802.11 local area network, you would want to have it outside your firewall and have a VPN connecting the two endpoints.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, that thought had occurred to me a couple times to experiment with it, but I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
What kind of physical area can these 802.11 networks span?
Depends on the equipment, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really mostly antenna based. The thing is, you're limited to how much power you can radiate.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on your configuration of your antenna, you can pick up a signal from very far away, even though someone's only allowed to radiate like 0.1 watts. You can still, from a very long distance, have a parabolic type antenna. There's other like Yagi type antennas that you can pick up these really low emissions from somewhere else. And then on the other end, you just have, all you need is a powerful collecting antenna to pick up your 0.1 watt transmitting from the other side. So in that, even though it's only 0.1 watts, and there's other amounts of wattage that you can put out,
is there
legally, but 0.1 is basically what you're working with. It just depends on the size of collecting antenna, and then you get directional. I mean, people have talked about going 5 kilometers with this. I know 2 is very feasible. It just really depends on your antenna configuration.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is there a peer-to-peer or like a repeater aspect to it?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the, we had talked about like a month ago or so, was it, there's different cities that already have multiple hop repeatered areas where you could go in and actually move around in large distances and still have a wireless connection to a free, well, you know, pseudo-free, you have to buy the equipment.
A free net.
Yeah, free net, basically, you know.
Yeah.
And this is caused a little bit of trepidation with the, you know, large for-fee service providers, but I think it's all going to integrate in a way that's going to make everybody benefit. So it's all rolling out right now, and there have been some of these networks set up in and around the Capital District as testing has evolved, and it's going to be deployed on a much larger scale in the very near future.
There have been a couple interesting things I've seen done. There was one experiment where somebody had taken and they got a magnetically mounted antenna that they put on top of a car. It was a collinear antenna, so it had about a 3 decibel gain to it. And they drove around New York City and the surrounding areas, and they mapped out where all of the 802.11 networks were located. And they actually put this map up on the internet. So if you happen to go to the appropriate website, you can see for yourself where all these networks are and roughly what they're doing. I mean, you can't tell a great deal about them because most of them were appropriately secured, but you can see, I believe they mapped out which ones were not. It's kind of an interesting thing. Besides, and which
they're all theoretically private.
Yes,
or they were. They were intended to be private. Private.
Let's put it. Let's call them privately owned.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let's see. I suppose we could run from 802.11. We could go into the topic of broadband because really 802.11 is one of the technologies that could potentially deliver broadband service. And on that front, I've got an interesting one here. Apparently, and unfortunately, I don't have the absolute most up-to-date information on this one, but apparently yesterday, the Excite at-home network was at risk of finally actually going down, and we've discussed before on this airspace that they were in some sort of financial trouble. And depending on the decision of the judge, let's see, this is according to spokeswoman Stephanie Xavier. She says, "All I can say is we're in active negotiations with the cable companies. We're doing all that we can to maintain service. But that many of the cable companies that carry Excite at Home have informed users that their service could cease after Friday," that being, of course, yesterday. And I'm not quite sure what the solution to that one is. I know that DSL in a large number of areas is just not really honestly viable. Okay, technically, if you really want to poke at it, dig, scratch, and fight with the local telco, yeah, you can get DSL. But I just consider myself I consider myself lucky to be in an area where the broadband service comes from a different source than Excite right at the moment, because quite frankly, I don't want my internet connection going dark.
Yeah, actually something similar happened to us at work. We had a DSL connection, and pretty much without much warning, it just was gone. That was it. The company went out of business. Kabam. We had no internet. We had to dial up, and only one computer could dial up. So everybody had to use this one computer in the whole office to dial up. And I think it was about 2-3 months later, after struggling with our current service provider, whom I will not name, maybe 2 or 3 months later, I don't know, it seemed like an eternity, we finally got some DSL service back.
Amazing.
Hopefully they won't go under.
Well, you know, it's not just a question of the DSL providers themselves having problems, but I mean, one of the reasons why, one of the reasons how I ended up with the particular email address I have, which, by the way, is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. If you want to send me an email, please feel welcome to do so. One of the reasons why I ended up with that particular email address is because of the fact that Verizon stood squarely in the way of every effort I made to put DSL service into my home. After 163 days, the DSL service still didn't light up, and it wasn't their service. It was basically they had provisioned the line incorrectly, however, and the end result was that I finally gave up and went to a cable modem, which I had not initially wanted to do. We have a caller on the line. Let's see what we have here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
No, I'm not going on the air. I'm trying to ask a question, not on your program.
Okay, well, can I put you on hold for a minute?
Sure.
All right. Okay, so we'll take that caller off the air. Fawn, can you go let Matt know there's a caller? All right. Let's see. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, I was going to address the fact that everybody will eventually have a problem with their internet service, or they'll eventually see the need for having more than one connection, and actually a community-based connection.
Which, of course, brings us back to 802.11.
Right. Or there's other technologies that we can use to set up networks that don't rely on an outside source to be configured. They can be configured by people, individuals, neighborhoods. And if these are not done, then you'll continuously experience these, you know, I don't know what to do, they won't do anything for me problems.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I'm not really sure how exactly you would implement this in a TCP/IP environment. However, I do know that those of us who are in the amateur radio community have had such wireless networks for a decade at least. we're not using TCP/IP mostly. We're using our link level protocol is a variant of the X25 protocol. But we can bring nodes online anywhere, anytime, and they just work.
Right.
And that would be really the goal that we would want to aim for with whatever we might be doing in the future with 802.11 and 802.11b, or A, rather.
And other technologies that are going to become available. It's right now, I think the biggest barriers are just the contracts, the legal contracts, where when you sign up with a service, basically if you read the fine print, that is, you can only use the service. Well, the internet really, on a technical or a mechanical level, is something that is shared. It is only restricted by paper documents. So one of the reasons why this isn't really taking off is because people are signing all of these agreements, and they have to learn that they have to choose a provider that doesn't restrict them from their use of the connection. So if their neighbor's system went down and they had to get a security call out, then they should be allowed to connect their neighbor using whatever means, whether it's through the power line or the 802.11 or air, or whether they run a cable from house to house, they should be allowed to get certain communications out to, at least for public safety, for starters. And then once that happens, people will realize, why would I want to sign up with a provider that doesn't allow me to do what I want with my connection? And then they'll start choosing providers that allow them to do things within their community. Like if they have a business and they're not using their connection for 16 hours a day, like they could allow a not-for-profit or a church or a synagogue or a mosque down the street to use it to educate or to solve some other problem. So I think people will be looking at the contracts a little bit more severely in terms of granting them permission to do really what they want with their internet connections.
Phil, you've been awful quiet. What do you think?
I'm just trying not to talk because I had my wisdom tooth extracted yesterday.
Oh.
And it's still rather sore. So
I had that done last month.
I had no idea. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I'll show it to you after the show if you want to see it.
No, that's okay. Now, my other half had the same thing done about 4 or 5 months ago, and no, it's not pretty to look at. So, yeah, if you want to rest your jaw, go ahead and do that. I had no idea that you just had that done. Okay, well, what was I saying? You were just saying that...
I was saying that we're not really being restricted by technology. Technology is there, and actually people's education of the technology is ramping up so fast that there's really
right.
not going to be any restriction on deployment. It's all contractual.
I heard... an interesting idea put forth some years ago. The idea was that if technology was the constraining factor right at the moment, we would all have rather than business being the constraining factor,
or the legal system,
we would all have terabit connections by now.
Absolutely.
And the way things stand right now, the whole concept of a terabit is just completely unimaginable.
Well, you wouldn't have a use for it either. I mean, you wouldn't know what to do with it.
It's like most of the computers probably wouldn't be able to keep up with the data flow coming in.
No, you can't pass that much data on a PCI bus.
Yeah. I remember one time, I think it was back in the Commodore 64 days, they had those high-speed serial interface cartridges, and you could hook a 28.8 modem up to a Commodore 64, but it's only going to pull in like 17, K baud of data. It just can't pull in anymore.
Yeah, and that was quite a bit of work just to get that much out of it. I think natively they topped out at 1200, wasn't it?
Well, the port, the standard data port, but the high speed serial cartridge had its own UART on board.
Yeah, exactly. What they had done with the native serial support was nasty kludge of implementing a UART and software.
Yeah, and a lot of people out there still are working with, Pentium 300s or 400s, and, it's fast enough to do most everything you need to do, but if you have, connections that are, terabytes, they're not going to be able to fully use all the bandwidth anyway.
True. Well, even a gigabit connection is difficult to fill.
Mm-hmm. No? Well, when I was down at the, when they were when the local... See, I don't know if I can actually say these companies' names, so I'm just saying that when our local cable provider was, like, renegotiating their contract or franchise, because actually it's the cities or the people who have control of whatever domains, like the city of Troy would have a franchise and allow a cable company to come in and operate a cable system. They have to give back certain things to the community free library connections. There's certain things that are required, and it's all in the planning stage where these things are defined. And one of the things that I was pushing for, and somehow people with these kind of ideas get squeezed out of the process, but I was pushing for a really basic, when you shut a service off, you have to leave at least a minimum connection so that like a scream for help can get out. When they shut these services off, they shut them off completely. Whereas, if they left on 2K, you know how small 2K is. 2K was like, 20 years ago, we had 2K.
Yeah.
So, if they could leave on just the 2K that said, okay, well, I know I can't do anything useful with this except for scream for help. And those kind of ideas can be put forth and these companies can be forced to implement them if that's what the communities want. In order for those franchises to get renewed, they have to do certain things, like keep a lifeline system operational. You can't just shut something down.
I think that before we can really get to the stage where we can demand such things of the providers, we're going to have to get to the point where we consider internet provision to be an essential service. And right at the moment, it's just not at that stage. Right at the moment, internet service in general is a luxury item. Regardless, and it's still. I'm not sure what the latest figures are. Anybody know what the current saturation level is? Like, what percentage of households have got internet access? I'm seeing a lot of heads shaking back and forth.
I seem to have heard like 70% of Americans have access to the internet, one way or the other.
Yeah,
70%.
So it's getting close.
Yeah,
it's getting close to that level.
But what I think that the real positive changes for people that are going to take place are when they start realizing that this is something that is theirs, that they can use on their own, that they can demand certain basic features like security out of their internet connections, not insecurity, which is what's being offered them right now, or the built-in lack of security that's been the modus operandi that people are getting used to. Like, how many people do you know that actually use your encryption feature on the email?
Not many, actually. I have it installed on mine, but I don't actually use it very often because there aren't very many people to talk to who would be able to read the message once it was received.
Right,
and of course,
same way for me.
They have to have the software installed and keys generated and sent to me before I can proceed. What, Phil?
Yeah, speaking of security, why can't like McAfee or Norton screen for certain types of spyware as well? And although spyware is not really a virus in itself, a lot of people don't really want it on their systems.
I don't know, it would be it would seem like an obvious thing, wouldn't it? We have a caller on the line, so let's see who we have here. Hello, caller, you're on the air. I guess they didn't want to be on the air.
There's a website you can go to. It's called AdAware.
Yeah, I downloaded
Okay, ad-aware.com.
But there's a problem with that too, because Kazaa, there's a piece of spyware that's coupled with that called Sidor, and Kazaa won't work without that spyware installed.
So you have to go with. People have to just say, "I'm not going to use it if you force me to use something that's insecure." Now that I know what you're telling me is free is actually not costing me money, but it's costing me personal
privacy.
Information, privacy, whatever.
Right. Of course, the problem there too is that Kazaa, if I remember right, Kazaa is a file sharing service, mm-hmm. right? So basically, they're doing something that has gobs and gobs and gobs of competition from free things like Nutella,
LimeWire,
BearShare.
Even BearShare is spyware, though.
But the point of it is, you don't have to put up with it. You can just use something else. So why would you put up with it?
Because you're not computer savvy enough to know better.
Let's see if the caller is really here
education's
this time.
Education's a key.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I heard something about a new type of Napster service, but it's for pictures called Pornster. Have you heard about this?
Honestly, no, I haven't. Phil?
Why are you looking at me?
I don't know. You know, you don't need to go to a service like Pornster to get, you know, free porn. There's plenty of it out there.
I was just passing it around the room.
And as far as information goes as well.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't actually heard of that before. That's a new one on me. But I do know there's plenty of free sites out there with or without Pornster anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Okay. Any other questions or comments, please feel free to give us a call, 518-276-6248. And we need to take a moment for a public service announcement. Joint Action and Community Service was established in 1967 in order to help Job Corps graduates make a smooth transition from the residential Job Corps facility back into their home communities. These young people come home with new skills, education, and vocational training, but they often have a hard time adjusting. JACS advisors are the key to making this transition as smooth as possible. They welcome young men home from Job Corps and provide them with support that they need. If you would like to help a young person succeed in your community, please call JACS at 1-800-251-0277. Remember, youth are our richest resources. They are the leaders of tomorrow. Okay. And with that, we're back. And, phone line was still lit up, and I was wondering why. Okay. I guess what we could do at this point is probably take a couple minutes break, and we will be right back after this. You're listening to WRPI. The show is Little Brother, and Faisal has arrived to bring us. I can't think of what the name of your show is, Faisal.
Window on Islam
is up next. So we're going to close it up for now, and we'll see you this time next week. Why don't we just go around the room? One last comment, everybody?
Well, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Sydney.
Goodbye.
So long.
Okay.
Farewell. I'm sorry, I just saw The Sound of Music last night.
Oh, jeepers. All right.
Bye-bye.
Window on Islam is up next. This is WRPI Troy.